How do you write a memoir by President Trump when you are not President Trump? Kurt Anderson joins us to talk about his faux memoir, You Can't Spell America Without Me, co-written with Alec Baldwin. Who are some of the key codebreakers of World War II? Liza Mundy will be here to talk about her book, Code Girls. Our children's books editor, Maria Russo, will talk about this fall's Best Book for Kids and the winners of our 65th Best Illustrated Book Awards. Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Liza Mundy joins us now, fittingly, from the Newseum in Washington, D.C., to talk about her new book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Liza, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you just did an event with the author of Hidden Figures. There's kind of a moment right now for these books, it seems, about women, you know, having done great things in the past and curiously overlooked for having doing it.
Absolutely. Margot Lee Shetterly made the point at our panel that it's as though somebody flipped on the light and there were all these rooms full of women there who had been there all along. I thought that was a great metaphor.
What brought you to this story? How did the light switch on for you?
My husband was reading a declassified NSA history about one of the smaller code-breaking projects during the war, and it mentioned that 90% of them were women, and I just thought that was extraordinary, and I went out and spoke to the historian at the NSA, the National Security Agency, and the curator of the National Cryptologic Museum, which is our version of Bletchley Park. They were both women, and they laid out this much larger story of thousands of women being recruited to come break German and Japanese and other codes during the war. So, you know, as they were sitting there laying it out, I couldn't believe that it hadn't been told.
Okay, I have to go back and just break apart that sentence a little bit, because you said very casually that your husband was reading this recently declassified document as if he were reading the latest issue of Sports Illustrated. Why was he reading this?
Well, I'm lucky to be married to somebody who reads declassified documents for fun and pleasure on weekends. He's always been interested in the Cold War period, and this particular document had to do with our project to break the Soviet code systems during the war, which we weren't supposed to be doing. They were our ally, and the project was called Venona. It was top secret, and it was mostly women who were doing it, and most of them were school teachers. And then that particular project continued during the Cold War for many years, actually, and it continued to be mostly women who were working that project. So that's what he was reading.
So it started off not with the school teachers recruited by the Army, but with the Navy in 1941. Is that correct?
Right. And that's what I learned once I started diving into the research, that immediately after, and even a little bit before the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, the Navy realized that it needed just infinitely more code breakers, communications intelligence officers. And I actually found a document at the National Archives. The Navy was producing weekly memos about where it was getting its cryptanalysts, where it was looking to find people who could do it. And there was a memo that said, new source, women's colleges. So somebody in the Navy had the bright idea to start approaching the women's colleges.
Why did they go to women's colleges? They went to the Seven Sister Schools, right?
Yes, the Navy had been historically, it would recruit its intelligence officers from the Ivy League. Mm-hmm. So when they, and obviously immediately after Pearl Harbor and we entered the war, the men started shipping out. I mean, suddenly men were unavailable. So the Navy thought, well, the next best thing, we've been recruiting from the Ivy League, so we'll turn to their female counterparts. And so that's where women received these secret letters, selected women from the senior classes at Wellesley and Smith and Bryn Mawr were secretly invited to these meetings where they would be asked, do you like crossword puzzles and are you engaged to be married? And I should say that the deans and presidents of these women's colleges were very eager to serve the war effort. They were also very crafty, and they realized that the war was an opportunity to give their female undergraduates more job opportunities. So they were also working closely with the Navy to identify and then train their most promising senior women.
Who was behind this effort to recruit these women? Was there one person in the Navy who made this decision, who was the driving force?
Not so much at the Navy. I mean, there had been a woman, an incredibly important woman civilian at the Navy all during the 1930s. She was a Texas school teacher. She was a genius in math and languages. Her name was Agnes Driscoll. And she had sat at a desk day after day in the 1930s diagnosing how the Japanese fleet code worked, the main code system that the Navy used. It was what was called a super enciphered code. And she was basically doing decryption. And so the Navy did have a history of using some female civilians to do this work. Agnes Driscoll was legendary. The men who went out to the Pacific after Pearl Harbor and became famous later, they were all trained by her. So there was a history of women doing this work, which sort of a little bit of it seemed secretarial, and it wasn't that important before World War II. People didn't believe that code breaking could be used in battle, that it could be done quickly enough. But during World War II, with the Battle of Midway, which completely turned on American code breaking, and all the guys who did it had been trained by Agnes Driscoll, that's when it was suddenly put on the map and they realized how important it was going to be. So I'm sorry, this is a lengthy way of saying that there had been some women in the Navy operation back before it was truly prestigious. And so it didn't come as a complete 180 degree turnaround.
So you mentioned that some work was secretarial or seemed secretarial in nature, but what was the work of these codebreakers? It was not in the day-to-day all that interesting necessarily, right?
Yeah, it varied. And once the women got recruited, I mean, there were 4,000 women doing it for the Navy. There were 7,000 women doing it for the Army. There were innumerable code and cipher systems being used, you know, during a global war where communications had to travel for thousands of miles. So the German U-boat commander was communicating with all his U-boats. The Japanese Army was communicating with their headquarters. And we were snatching all these signals out of the air. And different systems required different methods. But the one that I just talked about, the Japanese naval code, all the words would be rendered as five-digit code groups. So it might be like 6789. But then they would be enciphered, and another set of numbers would be added to them, and that's what would be radioed. So the people doing the work had to strip out that additive in order to get down to a code group that might announce, say, the noon position that a ship was going to be at the next day. So they had to do it very quickly. So it was repetitive, but it was also stressful and urgent. And they all had brothers or fiancés or husbands who were in the war, so they felt enormous responsibility, and they were always told, you know, you cannot make a single mistake. So even if it was repetitive, it was urgent and stressful.
And the hours were long.
The hours were long. They worked 24 hours a day, so they were on shifts. And ultimately, the Navy opened up, the Navy created the waves, and even enlisted women who hadn't gone to these, you know, elite colleges, if they had aptitude and intelligence, they could join, and they joined the military, and they were on what the Navy called watches, which is what we would call shifts. So they might be working in the middle of the night.
So for people who are familiar with sort of the Bletchley Park version of this story over in the UK, what was different about America's decrypting sort of operation?
We had a bigger operation, actually. It's not as well known as Bletchley Park, but I think because really there's not a sort of a place like Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park has sort of a glamour to it, and it's one location. We had the Army and the Navy doing this work in two separate locations. You know, anybody who lives in Washington like me is not surprised.
And Bletchley Park had tennis courts.
Tennis courts, yes, and the sort of the glamour of the debutantes. But we actually had a much bigger operation. We had more women, and we were working more code systems. The Bletchley Park was mostly concentrating on the German Enigma machine that was used by their Army, their Air Force, and their Navy, the Germans. We were working a lot of different Japanese code systems. We were also cooperating with the British on the German naval U-boat codes. In fact, we pretty much took over that operation, and it was pretty much exclusively being done by women by the end of the war.
How successful were they?
Well, we completely cleared the Atlantic of the U-boats. They were completely eliminated from the Atlantic Ocean so that the convoys could travel to England to bring our sailors and soldiers to make the D-Day landing. So, I mean, that was completely successful. We broke the Japanese naval fleet code over and over. And also, the Battle of Midway is very famous, but one of the most important efforts during the war was the sinking of the supply ships that were supplying the Japanese army on all the islands they had captured and the land masses. And that was literally school teachers who had been recruited by the army, civilian school teachers who traveled to Washington. I have a number of them in my book. They didn't know what work they would be doing, and they were put to work decrypting the enciphered system that the army used, and they sank supply ships. They sank thousands and thousands of supply ships. And I even found a poem in the archives about school teachers sinking the shipping of Japan. And that doesn't get talked about as much because it took place over the course of months. But in the end, most Japanese army deaths were as a result of starvation or disease. And that was because the supply ships had been sunk and they couldn't get food and they couldn't get medicine. So it had an enormous impact on the Japanese army and the course of the war in the Pacific.
What was life like after the war for these women? I mean, did they just sort of pack up their papers and go home to their former lives? Did any of them continue after the war was over in some capacity?
Yes, but the women had been told during the course of the war that they would be shot if they talked about what they were doing. You know, you couldn't, it was treason to talk about a top secret project during the war. And so they told people that they were secretaries. And because they were women, people believed that the work they were doing couldn't be important. Then after the war, most of them went home. They were given a medal. If they were with the Navy operation, they were told never to show it to anybody. I had to persuade some of the women to even show it to me now. And they were told never to talk about what they did. And in fact, that oath of secrecy was lifted in the 80s and 90s when some of the men started talking and historians started writing about this, but nobody ever told the women. So they went through most of their lives never talking about it, and the majority took it to their graves. But there was a cohort of women who continued with the work after the war and rose to very high positions in what is now the NSA, the National Security Agency. So the first female deputy director of the NSA was a 22-year-old codebreaker during the war. And those women tended to not get married and not have children, because if you were going to be in high-level government intelligence work after the war, you were a woman, you really had to just completely commit yourself to that work.
So you mentioned that some of the women were kind of reluctant to talk about certain things. You interviewed more than 20 former codebreakers for the book.
I did. I found them. And, you know, since the book has been published, I've heard from more. They tend to be online because they were code girls then and they tend to be code girls now. So, yes, I did track down 20. And in some cases, I had to convince them that they wouldn't be put in prison anymore if they did talk about what they did. Yeah. But at this point, I think most of them realize that books have come out on these efforts and that they were essentially neglected in the official history. And they were very understandably proud of their work and eager to get credit. And one of the women said to me during my reporting, you know, I just hope that I live long enough to see the book published.
Wow.
And she did.
I would love to hear about one of your conversations. Tell us about one of the codebreakers you interviewed in person, about their time and how you found them and what those conversations were like and what her story was.
So a friend of mine went to visit her mother, Wellesley, class of 43, in an assisted living facility in Maine. And she came back and she said, okay, I've got three for
Whoa.
You. So up there at that facility in Maine, there were three former codebreakers who had been recruited from Wellesley and Smith. But one woman, Jane Case Tuttle, who had actually joined as an enlisted woman, she came from a very affluent family. Her father was a physicist, Theodore Case. And she when she enlisted in the Navy, she thought she would be made an officer because she had gone to music school, but they didn't consider that to the equivalent of college. So she went in as an enlisted woman, and she had great stories about what it was like from her upper class background to go through the enlistment process. She was nearsighted, and she had memorized the eye chart so that she could make it through that part of it, but she wasn't prepared for the naked physical when she had to actually take off her clothes, because men in the Navy did, and a woman actually drew the number, I think it was 9, between her breasts and said, okay, go stand between 8 and 10. And so because she was so nearsighted and had hidden her spectacles, she had to go around peering at other women's breasts in order to make it through the physical. But what was so wonderful was that simply because of her intelligence, she got routed to the code-breaking facility, and she had some wonderful tales. She was tested one time when she was walking the streets of Washington. She was picked up in a car because during the war, people were told to pick up members of the military and give them a ride. And this person in the car started saying, he was a man wearing a raincoat. His wife was there. He said, "So what do you do in that big facility up there in Northwest Washington? What do you Navy women do there?" And she said, "Oh, I fill inkwells and I sharpen pencils and I give people what they need." And he said, "Well, what is that Q patch that you all wear stand for?" And she didn't have a script for this. And she said, "Oh, well, it's Q for communications, because the Navy can't spell." And when he let her out, he reached over and opened the door, and the sleeve of his raincoat hiked up, and she saw that he was a Navy admiral, and he had been testing her ability to keep a secret.
Wow.
And she passed. But she also talked about realizing that she was, in fact, very, very good at math. She had grown up being sort of discouraged in that realm, and she was working the Japanese Naval Fleet Code. She talked about the stacks of messages she would have every day, the volume of the Japanese naval messages, and knowing when a fleet action was about to happen or something was about to happen in the Pacific, because the stack would get even higher. So even though the women were landlocked in Washington, they were tethered to the action in the Pacific, and a number of them knew what was happening to their brothers and their fiancés.
Wow. Well, the secret is out now. Liza, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a great honor to be on your podcast.
The book again is Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II by Liza Mundy.